either ditched. And you experience this occasionally if you ever go and empty an old bookshop, like some sort of South Coast town or whatever, and the owner has not been there for 10 years, and somebody just sells the shop and the entire stock, and you'll go through, and there'll be boxes and boxes and boxes of things that really were just the stuff that he or she couldn't find it easy to dispose of or easy to sell. And now, you have to go back and you have to go through all that stuff again when it's there to make sure that nothing of value has ever, you know, escaped in the first place. So if you bought, it's one of your issues, one of the things you have to talk about later, if, for example, you bought a box of 150 letters from somebody and you went through it and you discovered that there were two letters from Agatha Christie, one from Churchill and one from Ian Fleming, the considered thing to do was to take those out and to sell them separately and then to see what you could do with the rest at a later date. So the first rule now is very clearly never cull, never extract, never rewrite the historical record in any way, shape or form and leave everything in its context, its the correct sedimentary layer, and keep on sifting and keep on digging, because it's not up to the person who's doing the digging or the sifting to necessarily know the importance of what they're looking at. It's a best guess situation. That's up to people later on, and there should be a long line of people constantly looking, sifting, digging and revisiting after it has come from the auction house and gone through me, off my floor, away from my cat, and then eventually down to you lot. So you need, it's no point in going and looking at a picture and then just taking out the brightly coloured bits. You will need the whole canvas at some point. So to you now, that seems very obvious, but for quite some time historically, and on numerous levels for booksellers, collectors and institutions, it was part of the ebb and flow of the movement of materials. Space and time are always at a premium, both for you and for me. Institutions have a hard time sometimes with duplicates. So how do you preserve a collection? For example, there's one knocking around at the moment where the bookseller in question is having issues with this. How do you preserve a collection which has something linking it all together, but a lot of duplicates? So if you find an institution that might want it, they're not necessarily going to want 200 or 300 books that they already have in their lists. But that means breaking the collection up, which is something you also definitely don't want to do. So there has to be some sort of compromise that can be met, or some sort of arrangement that can be talked about. Time is the enemy of the bookseller. Value and depth and importance are added over time. The right place to put something is discovered over time. And time is often the thing that booksellers don't have in any large quantity. There's no money in books, or at least nowhere near as much as there is in other markets and industries and professions. And the chances are that if you encounter someone, and this is actually paraphrasing Lord Baer, who's sitting down there in front, if you encounter someone who's been in my trade for long enough, it's down to one of two reasons. They either don't know how to do anything else, me, or they don't want to do anything else, which is also me. Most of us sell books in order to be able to keep selling books. I have to do it so I can keep having people's lives spread out on my floor, or clamoring to be heard from my shelves, or from the utterly horrifying purgatory that is my storage locker. It's just a mountain of things I have to work my way through, and I think I'll be like, booksellers aren't going to retire, especially current generation booksellers. I will never retire. I will just end up, I'll probably never own anything either, but I will just end up working through these vast piles of things until I drop dead at some point. My mid-60s, sad, broken, lost, and with a very angry cat that will then eat. So from the point of view of immediate need, deciding to sell mainly to institutions, which is a decision I made kind of fairly early on in my independent career, is the kind of good, worthy, ethical decision that really pisses off your accountant. I prefer to sell to institutions. I do sell to collectors, and I do sell very rarely to the trade, which is kind of an accident of the things I deal in. But also there's this thing where I don't really offer much to collectors and the trade, but I do offer to institutions. There's loads of reasons for this, but the one that doesn't make any sense, but is the one that affects me most when I'm making a decision, is if I sell to a collector or the trade, often the item, the thing is still at risk. If I sell to an institution, it's safer. If I sell Jane to an institution, she's safe. If I sell her to a collector, and there's a really good example happening at the moment, one of the largest and most important collections of weird, supernatural, and speculative fiction for the last 60 years is currently sitting on its shelves, disintegrating and being sold off piecemeal and in tiny shreds, because book collectors believe that they're going to live forever, and when they're eventually persuaded that this isn't going to happen, often the other people around them don't really care and don't really have much idea of what this thing is that they've been doing for 40 or 50 years. So there is literally a house in the north of England which is just full of books and correspondence and documents, and it's going to stay there until the roof gives in and it all falls to pieces and it will be gone forever, which is a dreadful tragedy and the kind of thing that people like ourselves don't want to be happening. Where was I? About to burst into tears, I think. Yes, that's right, you think they're going to live forever and then they don't, and then nobody cares anymore. Oh, you used to get it all the time when I worked on Charing Cross Road, people come in and go, can you come and have a look at my books? Because I'm getting old now, my kids don't care. Yeah, no problem. Offering things to institutions is often time-consuming. Like, you have budgets, and you have deadlines, and politics, and you have treaties that you've made with various other people, and you apparently have all these kind of like institutional demons that you have to sacrifice to, and they're gods to appease. It's a huge mystery from our point of view, but you know, great, you do you. I can only offer things to one place at one time, and then that further stretches the time process because you have stuff to do, and it'll take a while to get back to me, and then I'll take a while to get back to you, and it will get very complicated. But it's the way that I prefer to do things. Also, the person who wants a thing, if I end up selling a thing to one of you, is not the person who will pay me. And that also operates in a completely different timeline. Institutional speed is very different from book trade speed, often differing by long, lean months, which annoy my accountant and irritate all my creditors and absolutely infuriate my cat, who really likes the bougie cat food. Institutions often have far more questions. They often require secondary cataloguing. I've been trying to sell a thing to a very notable institution. I was so proud because they contacted me and said, we'd probably like to buy this thing. And I was like, oh my God, really? I've always wanted to sell something to you. It's in a place called Oxford. It's round. And then they're like, that's great, thanks. And I wrote this catalog description for this item. It was like 2,000 words long. And it was kind of extensive and had pictures and all sorts of stuff. I was very proud of it. And they were like, we're going to need a much more complete list. And I was like, right, okay then, I'll do that. And then I sent it away to them, and then they sent it back and went, yeah, it's very good. Can you see pictures of absolutely everything, please? And I was like, okay, of course you can, that's no problem at all. So the process of getting this thing to where I eventually want it to be is just taking a lot longer than I would expect it to normally. But I'm okay with that, because eventually it'll be there. But wow, it's a lot of work. And they might be purchasing it for a reason which I haven't even thought of. So part of what I do is I look at it and I sort of, you know, this relief map, and I try and figure out where it fits and all the rest of it. And then I'll explain it to somebody else and I go, it's because of this. It's a huge important thing because of this thing here and this thing here. And they go, oh, that's interesting. It'll fit really well into my collection. It has no relationship to that at all. And I go, well, okay. I'll deliver it by hand. To further complicate things, there is the ethical consideration on my point, on my side, of which institution, which is where the kind of it sort of intersects with what Jose was saying, which is if you have a thing, you need to be putting it in the right place. If I had a travel manuscript detailing a seaman's travels through Australia and his dealings with the indigenous peoples, then there's very little doubt that that aspect of it should be the key focus of the item and its description, rather than, say, the travails of international shipping in the 19th century, or, you know, what European people who were kind of invading used to wear. It's just not, that's not as important. So that I have to look at that point of view, and then this engenders yet more research, and yet more time, and retweaking, and questions. So where's the best place for Jane to go? There's a wealth of social commentary, and it's a woman's entire life. So that really overshadows the ornithology and the military history, but they're there as well. So that enters, you have to find more dialogue and more points at which you can sort of talk about this kind of thing before I can put it somewhere. So both of our industries have a serious issue. This is kind of separate, but sort of related, with what I refer to as the magic bookshop stroke magic library trope, which is books and collections and archives magically arrive on the shelves with no entailed labor, and sit there dripping treasure like lost jungle cities, until some intrepid explorer comes along and discovers a thing that I wrote about quite clearly in my catalogue description, you wrote about quite clearly in your catalogue description, and then you explained this to the intrepid explorer and said you should probably go and look over there, and then he went off and discovered it. And that's excellent. And not annoying at all, in any way, shape or form. Similarly, almost with the what I was talking about, the line of custody earlier on, so I keep everything together, no sizing, no culling, none of these things, and that is reflected in the catalogue description, which goes with the book. And I personally, and I'm not sure if anyone differs at this opinion, you probably do, so feel free to throw things, I kind of feel that they should be part of the same thing, so they end up becoming part of the same context. Because if you separate them, and a lot of institutions used to do this, I don't know if they still do, you take out the catalogue description, and you either get rid of it or you put it somewhere else, filed in a large box marked catalogue description or something. And then the book is kind of, the item is kind of like denuded of context again, and then it has to have someone else come, and yet more work has to be done in order to put it back in the context it was in originally. So if you just, I tend to, for example, if I'm buying a thing with the intention of selling it to an institution and it has come from several other booksellers and still has traces of them and their catalogue description switched in, I just keep the entire thing together. So you will receive the same catalogue description done 5 times in 5 different ways by 5 different book dealers over a 75-year period, which I think is brilliant, because it's just, I mean, I don't mean I'm clever, I just mean I think the idea of keeping all these things together is brilliant, because it's a beautiful form of professional provenance, where it's sort of just this line is held, and that's, I kind of think that's wonderful, and should be kind of done with everything, but anyway, never mind. All of what we do is very hard work. You within your territories, and me within mine, but those territories intersect very frequently. And the real point of doing things like this, like RBNS and conferences, and I run a thing, I co-direct a thing called Your Canterbury Book Seminar, which is the British counterpart of CAMS, which was also hugely important and kind of much bigger, where our whole vision, I suppose, is one way of describing it. Our whole objective is to demystify and to render available and open to everybody, no matter who they are, what it is that we do and how we do it and where we do it. And the point of coming here, sorry, is that along these points of intersection, we can reduce the labour that we mutually have to do somewhat and make it easier to solve our mutual trade issues in these especially problematic times. We both have, for example, fairly major diversity issues within our respective trades and environment. We're working on them, but we also have problems of transparency, we have problems of security, and overall mutual issues with communication across the board. If we can work on those, then that makes the whole thing we both do much easier. Personal values, when shared, become community values and grow in power and effect. So opportunities like this give us a chance to share and build upon our mutual connections. They're incredibly valuable, and I would like to end by thanking you very much for giving me the opportunity to come here and do this and to talk about these things. And I would like to look forward to a future where we all look after each other a lot better than we are doing. Thank you very much.
So I have the incredible privilege of not only being a part of the session with these two guys, and Jay, thank you for being our moderator, but also introducing you to this interactive portion of the session. And I had this beautiful slide that seems to have gone off into this basic indifference. I really want to say all the afterlife jokes I can possibly think of, but I am seriously staring at each and every one of you about this. Anyway, this interactive portion works like this. I have envelopes in my hand, and I and my colleagues are going to break you into groups that we pick ourselves. Not really. We're just going to be like, you 5, you're in one group. You 10, you're in another group. We have 10 scenarios, and you're going to look at these little things and come up with something to report back to us. It's kind of like an extended discussion about what we've been talking about, and maybe some things that you are sitting there thinking, why aren't they talking about right now? So, without further ado, let's split you into groups. Don't worry, you don't have to move your chair. All right. So, also, by the way, I'm going to grab this mic.
Get me out of here.
Okay. Even if you don't feel like your participation, that is also totally fine. We may have mentioned that this session is recorded, so we thank you for your input, and you can leave at any time. I'm fine. So, I'm going to carry this mic around because I will be facilitating the recording deck. All right? We have envelopes. Okay. All right. So, we have 10 scenarios. I know a lot of you people in this room. I'm so happy to be here. So, they all have numbers on them. We know what they are. And we're going to make this one group back here with Sarah Horowitz and a couple rows behind her. And you can join this group with them. And these guys, how about these three guys in? Like these three were first to me group? Yes, okay, so there's a London woman. Can you raise your hand for the envelope? All right, so you three rows are one group together. And this is one group here. Looks like we got this first over there. If you don't have a group, find people you don't know and go talk to them. Because that's what our BMS is all about. All right. You can also sit down if you prefer. All right. You guys have an envelope? We have one here. Okay, so if you have a scenario, then read it to your colleagues and then discuss. And then I'll be back. So everybody, thank you for what I hope has been very enriching and engaging discussion with people you may not know until today. We're going to get to the reporting back portion of this session. You all got an envelope with a number.
This one's number 8.
Yeah. All right. So the way this is going to work is that I'm going to read the description that you were given. That's totally how it should happen. And then a representative from that group will, for the record, tell us what your thoughts were about that scenario. And if you don't want to, you can like whisper it in my ear. So we're going to start with group number one. These guys, yay. All right, group number one scenario is called The Afterlife of Donations. A donor bequeathed a painting by a famous artist to your institution, but your institution no longer collects art, does not employ paintings conservators, and does not have facilities to adequately care for or display this artwork in alignment with your institution's mission and values. What are your options and why? So, group number one. Hello.
Okay, after we shook and blanched, those of us in special collections who have this happen all the time, so on behalf of my group, we looked at this, the text, so we don't have enough information. No, don't know whether it's your fault. We don't know if there is a deed of gift or any agreement. So these are the questions we wanted to ask, whoever can come showing up with this. So that's where we thought we'd start at the core. Deed of gift, what other documentation? So if there is nothing, investigate if there are heirs to with the donor. And that would be number one, the answer to that. And if there are no heirs, no, we're back on our own again. The factor is, does our institution, sorry, really, oh, weird. Yeah. Do you have, do you have a policy, do we have a policy? And maybe you do or don't, or one needs to be formed. We also thought that if, is there an appraisal? And we don't mean an appraisal that is monetary alone, but an appraisal of what is this work of art? Where does it fit in the description? It is a famous artist, but we tried to deal with it as famous or not, where what kind of history might be attached to this painting. And if we are not the best people, not having the proper ways to care for it, what could we do? And we thought of, one, loan it to another institution that may actually have that kind of resources, or two, look at it as an opportunity that should offer, in the spirit of this conference particularly, something that diversifies and gives something of great value for our teaching and activities, then look for maybe a potential fundraising tool to get the resources to care for the painting and how to incorporate it into our actual mission and values.
Great. That was great. Thank you so much, guys. So, in the beginning, I sort of jeered and said, like, oh, this is my fault, but I'm actually quite grateful that what you all did was dissect all of the potential questions that we might have in our institutions in such a situation. We investigate things, then we make very seasoned determinations, and I love your suggestions that are multifaceted and respect this idea of perpetual care, but in whatever way possible, based on whatever conditions are available. Right? So that's great. We're going to move on to number two. What's group number two? Conveniently over here. All right. So. Scenario number two, donating your research and personal library to your institution. You taught for over 30 years, now you are ready to retire and are considering donating your personal library to your university. What will influence your decision? What kinds of conditions would lead you to choose to donate elsewhere? What guarantees would you need before you completed the donation?
Talked about this as kind of thinking of in our own shoes as librarians and educators. So we were thinking that the collection probably should reside in an institution that would benefit that institution most, which might not be our institution. So let's say there were a lot of duplicates, or in the personal papers, maybe your personal papers were of your life as an educator, and maybe they already have a large collection. Perhaps your alma mater doesn't have that kind of a thing. So we thought, because there's so much personal feelings wrapped up in personal collections, and even as a librarian, you probably don't want to put conditions on it, that maybe having someone to help you in an impartial way to evaluate what institution would really benefit from this collection. That's most of what we talked about. You know, obviously the integrity of the collection is an important piece, but it's not necessarily the most important. And we talked about the scenario of, would you rather have your books moldering away in the north of England, or would you prefer that they were used across a variety of institutions?
Okay, that's great. Any other comments? We can talk about this later. All right, I'm going to try to keep our timing going well. Is group number three over here? Oh, all right, group number three. So, group number three, the scenario is agreements and ethics. You approach an individual who has collected materials documenting their participation in a mid-20th century social movement. These materials have been stored for several years without climate control, are fragile, and contain personal identifying information. The individual is excited by the thought of making these items accessible, but apprehensive about parting with them. As a potential repository for this collection, what questions do you ask of the donor? How do you address ethical questions related to individual privacy rights?
This is a long one, sorry, yes.
Would there be a case where you would or would not have to address such ethical quandaries? How do you propose making these materials available and work with the donor to ensure access? Considering the previous storage conditions, no climate control, what challenges might that provide to your institution? All right, so you guys have a lot. Okay.
So, I'll be honest, we mainly use this as a large catharsis exercise in sharing experiences where we had maybe hypothetically
come across similar issues in collections that we may have come across in our institutional lives. So, there was examples and questions, and I think the main thing would be thinking about, I can't go through the exact list of questions that you would ask the donor, but I think a lot of it comes down to how open can you be with the donor? What is that donor's viewpoints? Do they have an understanding of ethical questions? We talked a lot about the fact that we all have to deal with these kind of scenarios where decisions were made 50 odd years ago, like Jose was saying. How do you deal with the legacy of those kind of questions? Some of the questions we came up with were, who else appears in these? What are those people's privacy rights? Can you communicate about privacy rights to the donor? How understanding is the donor about that? Were they like, no, we were all involved in the same group. It would be great. They don't care at all. Have you checked? Have you asked these questions? Is the documentation of these people's responses? How many of these people are involved in this social movement? And how many of them appear in these documents? So, and a lot of it is also the ethics of, if we are spending this much time with this one collection, what else are we doing at the same time? Because we have responsibilities to give access to as many things as we can. So there's a lot of, we don't have a necessarily, first of all, you would do point A, and then go to point B. It was very much about the fact that these are complicated questions that really have to be dealt with by a lot of people, because one single person is never going to be able to dot every I and cross every T. You even come up with those questions. It really is a collaborative thing around people in the organisations in which we're in. Legal counsel also really help.
Thanks, Charlotte. Moving on to number four. I know they're back here. Hi, guys. So number four, naming rights in perpetuity. You have donated millions under an eponymous fund to various cultural organizations. A major institution on whose board of trustees you sit approaches you about making a large gift, several more million, in exchange for which you will receive naming rights in perpetuity. You have an established record of giving to this institution. The donation represents a larger amount than you have previously given. As you consider the institution's proposal, what can you do to ensure your gift is distributed properly after your death? What concerns and stipulations do you propose to the institution as part of your negotiation? And I think at least two examples of that was being selfish. So, Garfries, would you like to report back for your group?
So our first question was, which we were a little unclear on, was what does in perpetuity mean? And then we had a discussion and then I came over and said, oh, in perpetuity in the real life example of this ended up being 50 years, which is a very short perpetuity. So really what we ended up kind of, not unlike Charlotte's group, kind of it became a little more personal. We definitely talked about how a very clear contract, deed of gift, et cetera, would be very vital to this, right? To make sure that we're actually, kind of setting out what it is that we had expected the institution to do. But I think more specifically, we were thinking, we could be the dream donor in this situation, right? And the stipulations that we set forth could be things like what you need, and what the institution really needs. Thinking that, there are plenty of these arrangements that, get written up and then 100 years later, things change, like electricity or the internet, for instance. So I think, but the main thing here was, you know, I think being clear for the institution, also being very clear for the donor, I think. And then just conversations too about, you know, what happens when everybody is dead, when that family is gone, you know, when that name is gone. Is there something set forth that, you know, is there something that we can go to as an institution? Is there, and how would you want, as a donor, to stipulate that? Or do you let that agreement die with your family? So some of the things we talked about.
Thanks, Kirk. One just little interjection I want to add to, as you might have noticed, some of these scenarios are slightly related to each other, and they really just embark our efforts to kickstart this conversation, because we all think about things, and it's better to talk about them with lots of other people too, like forever online. Are you guys group number five? Group number five is over against the wall, I think, right? Convergence of special collections and collection materials. We'll come back to you. You guys are eight?
Yep.
All right. So group number eight is over. You are a bookseller, and there is a bookseller. Who acquires at auction two letters in a single lot. They were written by two famous individuals, but their content appears unrelated. Do you separate them? What factors into your decision? Rebecca, would you like to speak for your group?
So our very nuanced answer is, it depends on a lot of things, and we have a lot more questions. I think we're all very, very suspicious of these seem to be unrelated. And have all agreed that a meaningful relationship could be established, or even suggested that they should be kept together, ideally, although we understand booksellers also want to make money. And that is, you know, selling them together is not necessarily a path to the most money in this case. I also think it's a very tricky question, there being only two, right? Because I think if there were 100, then you would immediately say, well, it has value as a collection because whoever collected it, and then it's like her collection, right? So I feel like that it's just two, you know, you've got a Mark Twain letter, a Poe letter or something, and it's like, well, I mean, exactly. And, you know, in that case, maybe you want to sell the Twain to the institution that has all the Twain and the Poe to somebody who's got a lot of Poe. And there's a good case you made for that as a librarian as well. So, yeah, that's some of the things we thought about.
Okay, great. All right. I'm boring in my chair. Great with myself. All right, I'm going to organize because I know you guys are five. What number did you guys have? Seven, social media outreach. All right, so scenario number seven, social media outreach. To bring more attention to a collection, you use social media platforms and shared images and brief descriptions of the materials. You have had correspondence with researchers, potential donors, you think, as well as students and bibliophiles about the materials they viewed on social media. Your institution is now on its fourth social media manager in as many years, and this person is not a librarian. Do you argue to your institution that social media is a useful outreach tool? Why or why not? How many hours per week do you propose be devoted to social media? If you do, explain your argument. So, I seem to remember as I walked around that there was maybe some just something. Anybody? Sarah? Hold on one second. There were words over
there. So I think we basically agree that, yes, social media is a valuable outreach tool, but it depends, as Rebecca said, on many factors, one of which is, so in terms of assessing things, it sounds like this institution is getting a lot of feedback that people are actually using in social media, but from many of our perspectives, we don't necessarily always know what kind of reactions we're getting on social media or what kind of effect it's having. So we talked a little bit about the importance of assessment and using that to figure out like how many hours a week you would want to devote to that. And then thinking about how do you assign people to do social media? Is it a question of you have someone who's really interested? But if not, like how do you assign someone working to sort of make that part of a job description or a team description and making sure that time is allotted for it if you do consider it a priority, so it's not just something that's added on if it really is an institution priority. And then we talked a little bit about sort of how social media has become like a sort of basically a requirement at this point. Everybody does, it's part of marketing, it's part of branding. And we were sort of going back and forth on whether it's important for the social media manager to become a librarian, and I think we sort of came down on the idea that there doesn't have to be, but they do need to sort of listen to librarians and understand what reasons we have for doing outreach that may be different from, say, if you work at an institution of higher education and maybe your ideas for outreach and your audience are different than, say, the college's communication department.
Sarah. All right. Themes that I'm hearing are like collaboration, time, listening. I'm making this brief because we're running out of time, speaking of which. You guys must be group six. Yes.
Six.
I guess so. I don't know. actually, it is a 9. You're right, Simon. Sorry. This scenario is about ad hoc databases and student projects. Because your institution has a limited budget, you're encouraged to hire student workers and have them work on cataloging and archiving quote-unquote projects. A large collection of 19th century books arrives. What sort of things might your worker look out for? How might this work differ if it is a retrospective project rather than one that revolves around a new acquisition? What about non-English materials? We ended like 6 more questions after that, so I'm just going to give the mic to what I perceive as your group leader, Simon Beattie, who is going to speak for you.
Hello. Yes, what we thought really a lot of this depends on 2 things. Firstly, the student's ability. Do they speak French or Spanish, or if they are indeed foreign language material? And the second thing is the nature of the collection itself, and hopefully you'll be led by that in your choice as to whether or not it's a good idea to have a student work on it. There is a danger, we thought, in this, an inherent danger, of having to do the work twice. You give it to the students to do, and then you end up just doing all yourself later. So that's something to think out about. One of our group points out that what tends to happen is quite the good students then graduate, so then you're back to square one trying to find another good student to do more work. One thing we thought, a couple of things we thought, what they should look out for when going through these books tends to be copy-specific material, annotations or marks of provenance, that sort of thing. I also just scroll down about possibly identifying conservation issues if you're looking through things in, this book's full of mould. Perhaps we should move it away from the other ones. Issues of funding, do you have a permanent person, do you have a part-time person? And also that's going to affect the amount of time taken, how long do you want it to take, how quickly do you need it done? The benefits of it to the student, some just put on their resume, that's what I said there, and that warm, fuzzy feeling inside. Someone very sensibly thought that the idea of putting on a blog, you just said about your social media things there, you put it on your blog, it acts as an outreach for the library, and it's something that the student could then, in fact, also put on their resume, saying, look, you can look at the work I've done here, I wrote a blog piece. Yeah, it shows that I worked at the library.
Thank you so much. I'm going to try to be completely mindful of everyone's time. And I know you all did lots of wonderful work, and this group split in 2. So there were so many people talking about these great issues. So what I'm going to do is do a dealer's choice. So we have convergence of special collections and circulating materials, which was handled by these wonderful people right here. Bibliographic evidence of ownership history and provenance documentation, that was literally group number 6, which I'm presuming is you guys. And the longevity of collections, how long is the long when we say long-term preservation? I don't know if you guys can arm wrestle it out, I don't know if you stand up. Show hands who wants to talk? 15 minutes. You were really excited. Okay, so, all right, great.
Yeah.
It was a team, I'm Lisa Marley, I'm first time at ND Scholarship Recipient and the first year student. And I'm like, UCLA, go Bruins. I'm going to keep it short because we had a long discussion, but there's a theme, it depends, opportunity, we don't know what that means, it's complicated, so we summed it up like we don't know.
So, they have other stuff written down, it's true. And yeah, right. So, my apologies that we sort of ran out of time, but I hope that your discussions were rich and wonderful and engaging, and I hope that we continue this conversation. We actually made a form. It's an anonymous form online, so you can like fill out the form, write down this URL, or find me or one of us later, and talk about your stories. Because the one other thing we want to give to everybody with this is that this conversation is evolving and ongoing, and we want to talk more. So thank you again so much for coming. This has been so fun. And we'll see you later.